Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everyone. This is week one, a podcast on the basics, primer to MS. My name is Christian Enzinger, and together with Professor Filippi from Milan, I'm co-chair of the panel MS within the EAN. And we're very grateful that EAN picked up this series to start off with this podcast, which I hope you will find interesting. I'm situated here in Graz, Austria. I'm a professor in neurology with a strong focus also in neuroradiology, but generally also running the MS center we have here. And it's my privilege to now be the moderator in the session and say welcome and thanks to your time to Professor Andrew Chan for the time of this moderation. I would just briefly stick to Andrew, if you allow, to make it a little bit more lively. Professor Chan is head and vice chairman of the Department of Neurology in Inselspital Bern University, a very famous university. He has trained extensively in neuroimmunology, starting with his doctoral thesis at the University of Hamburg in Germany, then also during his postdoctoral lecturer qualification in the University of Göttingen, then became 2012 a professor of neurology at the Ruhr University Bochum, Germany. And as I said, he's now working in Bern. He's received endless prizes and published extensively. He's board member of many influential boards, including also the ACTRIMS, and has been working there. So, Andrew, thanks for taking the time. And I think to start off with, it would be a quite natural question to ask you, what makes multiple sclerosis so interesting to you?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me here today, Christian. I'm really looking forward to it. Although I must admit the helicopter is just landing, so I hope you can hear me still. Well, you know, when I was a young resident, everybody was laughing. My former student colleagues, you know, who became surgeons or internists or so, just said, you know, you can diagnose a lot, but you cannot do anything. And that has changed. And especially in the field of MS, we have moved away from merely diagnosing funny diseases to really proactively treat patients. And this is a progress in many different domains, really, from basic science over really we've learned a lot about clinical trial methodology, but also, you know, we've learned now how to, for example, quantify effects and deliver effects for the quality of life of people with MS. And, you know, with the last word, people with MS, I think this is the most sort of personal remark I can make. So, many of my friends do have an MS, and also many of my colleagues. And it's always a privilege to counsel those people with MS who have a similar life situation to what I have, and on top have to deal with this chronic and sometimes severe disease. So that is something that really touches me and touches my personality.
And as you said, I mean, the treatment landscape has evolved dramatically and the face of MS has changed a lot. So we are now able to diagnose this also earlier with high sensitivity and specificity. So before we come to this, I would just, as a general notion, ask you about the framing of the diagnosis and conveying the diagnosis of MS, because I think this has changed a lot and people nowadays still have the picture of a wheelchair before them. So how, for instance, if you diagnose a colleague of yourself with MS, what is your general attitude and the framing of the information you give and you provide?
Yeah. A very important question, because especially younger residents sometimes get lost with, you know, all the diagnostic criteria, McDonald's and, you know, not McDonald's, as we all know. I believe what the people themselves say, and they always say, at least in the German-speaking countries, that's a picture that they draw, the disease of a thousand faces. And I think that you know, really describes the disease very, very well. What very often is meant is that you do have different clinical phenotypes or different symptomatology. It can, in an unforeseen fashion, hit everywhere. But for us also, I think it means we have a heterogeneity in pathophysiology. And also, you know, it has a very different impact on the individual itself. For some people, they can cope very well. For other people, it is very, very difficult. And aspects that are not very overt may become very, very complicated, you know, like in partnerships or also the sort of hidden symptoms, fatigue, cognitive aspects, these issues. I think really the heterogeneity is expressed in this picture of the disease of 1,000 faces in a good and also in a negative fashion really hits it quite well. And this is something I also try to convey and try to be very transparent on that.
Okay, thank you. I think that's very important, and also to come up with individualized treatment goals and stating that we want to keep persons affected with MS in their life. And as you mentioned, quality of life and all the different demands that come from it. If we bring it down to the progress we had done, and you mentioned already the McDonald criteria. So I'm assuming you are, of course, using them. So probably a few words about the correct use and the incorrect use and the clinical context it needs to be in a safe space. And then also touching about what is missed in terms of phenotyping. So what are your remarks and considerations on that based on your expertise?
Yeah, a very important question. Very dangerous question from your side, because given that you are one of the leading neuroradiology experts, and given that diagnosis heavily relies meanwhile on MRI criteria, the different clinicians and the specializations and also the neuroradiologists that have to work closely together. And I understand that one part of this series, podcast series, is also especially dedicated to MRI.
Yeah, it was just meant not to over rely on MRI findings apart from the clinical context. That's just, I think, a point that is very relevant to you and to many other people, because it's good to have a very low threshold of thinking about MS. But then again, if you overdo things, you might mislabel patients, probably.
I totally agree. I mean, it's quite clear. In the beginning, it was to stratify also inclusion into clinical trials, you know, to have refined diagnostic criteria. Now, meanwhile, that we do have good immunotherapies, I think early diagnosis is paramount also in clinical practice. However, still, you know, we need to make sure that we don't lose too much specificity for the sake of sensitivity. And like what you say, do not overinterpret and try to integrate into clinical findings. What you and into the clinical context, what you asked me is where I do see still, you know, need to improve is certainly, you know, the radiologically isolated syndrome and the difficulties also to try to catch subtle symptoms. We did talk about fatigue. We did talk about cognition. And a better sort of way to move around freely also in this early, very early phase of disease, the disease, presumably. I think that is where we need more data.
Okay. I touched upon a more holistic view on MS, attributing to all the factors we know, including cognition, fatigue, and more subtle and symptoms. In this context, what are the epidemiological key points that you find relevant that we need to consider? There's new data that came out on different aspects, vitamin D, for instance, EBV, smoking status, obesity, things like that. Anything you want to elaborate on?
I think the epidemiological data that really gives us clues on pathophysiology, that I find most interesting, both on aspects that we can modify and aspects that we cannot modify. You mentioned vitamin D. I think the evidence that it does play a role is overwhelming, both in sort of risk of developing NS and MS relapse. However, it's very clear that, you know, all these treatment trials with vitamin D are difficult to perform, and therefore we don't have a clear answer on that. Smoking, you have mentioned, I think this is something which has a direct impact on management. It's very clear that smoking increases, and also passive smoking increases, the risk of developing MS, but also the risk of disease progression. One aspect that I find interesting in terms of pathophysiology is that it's really, we're talking about smoking. If you think about the Swedish studies on sort of oral tobacco use, something which appears to be very sort of popular in Sweden, then it rather, if anything at all, ameliorates the risk of developing MS. So this really pinpoints to some subtle, more or less subtle lung inflammation that may play a role. And there again, animal experiments come into play from Alexander Flügel, for example, from Göttingen. So, you know, I like this sort of epidemiological observations that you can then link with basic science, and we have a lot of that. More recently, really, what I find very interesting are vascular comorbidities and in general comorbidities, given that all our MS people with MS will become older.
Absolutely. So it's becoming more comprehensive, and we need to assess this data in order to analyze them and put them on a patient level. And because you mentioned it, and I think it's so important, specifically thinking about treatment of this disease in terms of medications, what are the key points of pathophysiology that you deem important for a clinician? So can we work out which drug should work in which individual patient, or can we act as a group, or what's your take on that?
Very difficult question. I wish we could work out which drug is the best for a given individual or a given pathophysiology. We can still not, and this is due to the heterogeneity in pathophysiology, which, as you say, has a direct impact on the presumed mode of action of different treatments. I think really the heterogeneity is something to bear in mind, especially because each one of us is, you know, in contact more or less direct with also industry. They send out messages, and taking into account that we probably have a very heterogeneic pathophysiology, claims of being the best, or, you know, better than this and that may have to be ameliorated. I mean, it's very clear historically we started with T cells in the focus, also because of the animal model, and then because also our colleagues from rheumatology understood the role of B cells, and we do have some circumstantial evidence. And now we have a very successful story with anti-CD20. And now the novel wave will be microglia and their role in innate immune cells and their role, especially in chronic progressive disease and smoldering inflammation. And that's really the major claim of the novel Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitors, where we will expect data next year, and where probably we will see some approvals. But, you know, will one size fit all? That is probably not going to happen. And this is probably, for me as a clinician, the most important take-home message.
Yeah, and then it's amazing that the treatment on armamentarium is increasing, and we're allowed to think about that. But as you mentioned, being a clinician, you have to make choices. So what is your approach to therapy if we just stick with disease modifying? Do you have a certain escalation scheme or some parameters where you would resort to early highly effective therapy or even measure and monitor it is, so to detect treatment failure. So coming back to, for instance, the colleague you mentioned of the first manifestation of MS, what would be your key driving factors, decision-making factors to put him on disease-modifying therapy A, B, C, whatever?
In general, I am very proactive, I have to say, both in recommending early immunotherapy and also in recommending more active treatment. In the end, I think the ultimate decision is really a mixture of different aspects. You, for example, if you take the one colleague, I mean, I think it's certainly a difference if you have a neurosurgeon where a bit of tingling in the left finger may severely impact on his professional activities. I remember one of the first sort of natalizumab patients I had ever seen that was sent from as a second opinion from a different university hospital was a professional pianist, and she had this tingling in her left finger, and it's very clear this is a severe symptom for her, and it was very clear you go for a hit hard and early approach, and whereas I do have other people with them as colleagues who are hesitant and who are more sort of safety prone, especially also in times of COVID right now, and I try to weigh this in. So it's always a very individualized benefit risk assessment.
Yeah, I fully agree. It's the patient's personality. It's factors related to aggressiveness of therapy, as you said, and also the sequelae of individual symptoms and relapses. So I think this was very insightful, and we have to come to an end of this interesting conversation. And I would like to end up by some personal statement, which could be related to the extensive research you did and also acting as a clinician. During your career, things changed a lot, and you're still very young, but yet you can oversee several years of MS research. What do you consider the most important or even surprising new finding in MS research? Something you wouldn't have expected, or which was enlightening, or which helped you go along, because science and is also something that has to do with frustration. So what kept you going?
Very much follows your last remark. I'm always impressed by what we can learn from mistakes. So when I was still a bit, or still junior, I have to say, and when the first monoclonal antibody came, natalizumab, you know, I was educated like this monoclonal antibodies are the magic bullet, and they are so specific, and we will reduce off-target effects and all this. And then when we had the first cases of PML, I found it, not only it really shifted the field in towards a discussion of, as I said, benefit risk, and also neurologists, neuroimmunologists becoming more confident in their capabilities to deal with weird side effects. Now, you know, macular edema, ECGs, whatever, name it, and you have it, and we can deal with that. So I find that very useful. And then a piece of research, you may also remember there, I was really a junior at the NIH, Roland Martin, the altered peptide ligands, you know, following this clear hypothesis, you can target specifically autoantigen specific T cells. And they did it, and they really targeted them, but rather the disease in some individuals exploded. I think we learned a lot from that, not least that probably really most of MS is an autoimmune disease, one has to say. So, you know, learning by mistakes and having an open eye what negative findings we also have, I find that is very often very helpful also for our attitude.
and also for adapting to the situation and then finding countermeasures. Thank you very much for your time and your precious insights. This was really condensing vast experience within 20 minutes, and we can't cover anything and everything. So I would really encourage you to also follow the other sequels of this podcast and contact Professor Chan himself in case of any remaining questions related to this topic, or contribute to the panel of MS within the EAN. Thank you very much. Thank you, Professor Chan.
Thank you, Christian. Thank you.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.